difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
Do you believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome back to The Next Picture Show, a movie of the week podcast devoted to a classic film and the way it's shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Tasha Robinson, here again with
Keith Phipps,
Scott Tobias,
and Genevieve Kosky.
Last week, we discussed Peter Weir's Gallipoli, a 1981 film about two young Australian men who meet at a race and eventually meet again in World War I, where they've both volunteered and they both end up in the trenches together. That film is mostly backstory, and it only gets to the war at the end. By contrast, Sam Mendes' 1917 doesn't have any backstory at all for its narrative about two young men in the World War I trenches. It launches with those two friends, Lance Corporals Blake and Schofield, played by Dean Charles Chapman and George McKay, resting in a field when they're called up to deliver a message to a different unit well on the other side of the German front lines. That unit has an offensive planned for the next morning, but new aerial photography says they're walking into a trap, and all 1,600 men in the unit stand to die if they proceed with their charge. To add to the drama, Blake's older brother is in that unit. And so Blake and Show set off into a no-man's land that was a killing field the previous day. Peter Weir called Gallipoli a road-to-adventure movie, where the protagonist pair volunteered for action and seem to think it's going to be a lark. But Blake and Show know they're headed into potentially fatal danger, and they find plenty of it, from German tripwires to a downed plane to a raging river, not to mention plenty of men with guns trying to kill them. Mendes shoots it all as a coordinated, unbroken shot, or at least as the illusion of one. Like Alfred Hitchcock's Rope, 1917 takes breaks by zooming in on characters' backs or into dark places, but Mendes covers up those breaks almost seamlessly. And the takes we do get still take immense coordination, to the point where they almost detract from Roger Deakins' stunning cinematography and the skillfully modulated low-key performances. It's a startling film for a lot of reasons, built around style as much as story, and we'll dive into it right after this break.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
In your own time, gentlemen.
Must be something big if the general's here.
You have a brother in the 2nd Battalion?
Yes, sir.
They're walking into a trap. Your orders are to deliver a message calling off tomorrow morning's attack. If you fail, it will be a massacre.
We've got orders to cross here.
That is the German front line.
Hold back!
If we're not clever about this, no one will get to your brother. I will.
So guys, I'm just going to fess up. I don't like war movies. I resisted seeing 1917 for so long. I passed up so many chances to see it in the theater. I only really reluctantly sat down with it at home because we were doing this podcast and I'm hosting this podcast and I couldn't get out of it. And on some level, I resented having to watch yet another war movie. This movie sold me within the first 60 seconds.
Oh man, we wanted to annoy you.
The shot, God, the shot just of the two of them with that field in the background, and McKay has his eyes closed and is asleep, and it's just this moment of peace, and you know it's not going to last. It's so beautifully composed, and I knew about the gimmick of the film. I'd heard it described as very gimmicky and as just like an exercise in style over substance. But the way you meet those characters, like the pause of the moment, and then the way the film eventually wraps all the way around again to that first moment, as much of a gimmick as it may be, it's a gimmick that blew me away. I'm really curious what you made of this film.
The Terrence Malick bookends to
it. Oh my gosh, it's such a Terrence Malick film. You know, that's...
I don't know if the whole film's fair. Those moments, at least.
But here's the thing. We're not even into connections yet, but there's a moment in Gallipoli where Archie's writing home, and it's a voiceover in the middle of this chaos where he's dictating the letter. And I was like, is this where Malick got it all? Like, this is the most Malicky moment I've ever seen outside a Malick film. But yeah, you're right. The bookends on 1917 also just have that very, very Malick, you know, a pause in the midst of chaos and the unbelievably beautiful scenery kind of thing going on.
Yeah, I like this movie. There's something about it that keeps me from putting both my arms around it and like fully bringing it to my heart. First, I'm not sure what that is, because I think, you know, I do care about these characters. I think the performances are really good. I mean, you cannot deny the beauty of Roger Deakins' filmmaking. You know, some people really do not care for it. And I find some of the criticism directed at it kind of do find a little footy in my mind, which is, there is kind of a theme park ride to it. Like, let's hit every possible World War One experience. I think the video game comparison feels kind of apt too. I to the point where I feel like, oh, we must be at a save point because there's a recognizable British character actor. That said, I mean, I find it, you know, I think it's a thrilling piece of filmmaking. It may not necessarily bring anything new to World War One beyond the style. And there is, I think there's sort of reluctance to even to dig into what World War One was beyond a staging ground for these experiences. But, you know, I think in some ways, like 10 years from now, this could be a very influential film, or could still kind of look like a novelty in some ways. But I'm curious to find out. Scott, what do you think?
I'm a little bit on the more pessimistic side with this one. It's a technical marvel, and it's thrilling to watch. I've seen it a couple of times and could watch it at any point. It is very exciting. I mean, it is sort of a, you know, World War One, the ride kind of. And there's something weirdly liberating about it compared to other World War One movies, in that they're able to traverse that much territory in, sure, in that little time. I mean, that is really antithetical to what you see of World War One movies. And there's some opportunities there that Mendes takes advantage of showing you the sort of haunted aspects of things that had happened before, of abandoned trenches and of, you know, men draped over thickets of barbed wire and of you know, bombed out villages. I mean, all that stuff is all very vividly rendered. But I did feel like it was a style over substance thing for me. I didn't feel like it was a terribly nourishing film overall as anything more than just an experiential movie, which, you know, which was significant in that respect, but I didn't think there's a lot of depth there. What do you think, Genevieve?
I have to say, this is not how I expected the chips to fall in this discussion, because I took a lot of the same biases as Tasha into watching this film, and I had a very similar reaction to her. I really loved this movie, and I saw it in the theater, and I think I'm usually not too precious about, like, this is a movie you have to see in a theater, but this is a movie that I would, like, strongly advise a theatrical experience for. And the reason why kind of relates to this style over substance criticism that I kind of bristle at, because to my mind, the style is the substance, and I reacted to the style emotionally. Like, I cried several times during this film, and I was not expecting to. But the reasons I cried had less to do with what was happening to the characters and more to do with just what I was seeing on screen. I think I've talked before on this podcast about how I come down with spectacle tears a lot just when I'm seeing filmmaking spectacle. I get it a lot at Broadway shows too, like during opening numbers, just when the visuals and the oral components are just like hitting at such a high level, and it hits something in me. And I got that a lot in this movie. But also just like kind of I was reacting to it on a storytelling level. Again, more than a character level. Like, I love movies that move from point A to point B, and like, this is maybe the most linear movie I can think of. Like compared to something like Dunkirk, which is another war movie that sort of upends the traditional style of a war movie. But whereas, like, with Dunkirk, I felt like I was responding more to the style component on an intellectual level and, like really admiring what they were doing. Here, I was just, like you said, it's a little bit like a theme park ride. But again, I don't consider that.
You love theme parks.
I do. But I love that theme park feel translated to a film, because you don't get that often achieved at this high of a level. And I'm totally down for 1917.
I'm going to totally backtrack on I would not watch this on my iPad at the gym. This is definitely one.
It'll keep you walking.
To see it at the biggest screen possible, preferably in a theater. I'm glad I did. I saw it in the Dolby house that we know so well from River East, where we were abused while watching Blade Runner 2049. Yeah.
I still have shaken baby Stench syndrome from 2049.
For context, there's a specific movie house that they had decked out with, so almost like a 4D kind of effect.
Yeah, there's rumble seats that rumble whenever the bass gets serious.
I think they calmed
it down. We talk about
it
fairly extensively on our Blade Runner.
Yeah.
But when I went to the press screening and it was in that house, I'm like, oh no.
Yeah. I think they figured out like people don't necessarily like that.
Yeah.
It's definitely been modulated down, or maybe there's just no movie with that much bass. But like things like Rise of Skywalker, there was enough rumble in the movie to give you kind of a sense of when things explode. But I haven't had that feeling of being violently shaken.
They should have seat warmers
then.
Like in cars, those fancy cars. That's what they should invest in.
Okay, Mr. Diversion.
My theater had seat warmers.
They have seat warmers?
What?
Yep. It's a recliner and seat warmer.
Huh.
Okay, we have a new answer to that feedback question from the last one.
New frontiers and falling asleep at movie theaters.
The proper way to see a five-hour movie is in a warmed seat that occasionally rumbles to keep you awake.
1917, warm seat or not, I would probably go to the doctor because there'd be something wrong with me. This was a very tense movie experience, right? Like it kind of reminded me of watching Uncut Gems again, movies that move. But it also kind of, again, to go back to the whole style is the substance argument, like this movie made me feel the reality of war in a way that war films rarely do. And the immersiveness is, I think, a huge part of that. And I think was the intent on Mendes's part.
I do agree that it feels like a video game. Like I had that comment myself at one point during the film. I think when he's running through the burned out ruins of the French city, and he's ducking in and out of buildings and having different encounters, and like especially ducking away from people shooting at him, there's a definite feeling of, this is a quick time event. You know, you have to duck in here. You have to wait exactly 4 seconds. You have to run to the next building. You have to make sure to get under this window. You have to jump back out in time to shoot this person and then jump back in. Like it
also
has
when he
that
dies
feel.
And gets another life.
Yeah, I was about to say, what about the scene where he picks up the health pellets or whatever? Yeah.
So yeah, I have that. I certainly get that feeling, but at the same time, I mean, games like Gears of War or Left 4 Dead that have this kind of like rolling, ongoing story where like every chapter just follows every chapter and you're there in the middle of it, I do find them very immersive. I do find them very exciting. Genevieve, I get what you're saying about spectacle tears. Like, I don't cry very often at the content of movies per se. But I have been moved to tears on a number of occasions just by, I wouldn't personally call it spectacle. I'd call it just craft. Sometimes there are times when films come together so perfectly for me that I cry just at awe. Basically, it's a feeling of awe at being impressed by what human beings create. And there are like things like the ending of Lone Star. I think there was a moment in Stranger Than Fiction, just when movies are spectacularly well put together and it impresses me. Sometimes I find myself moved to tears just because I'm so impressed. And this movie took me pretty close to that several times. I feel like the construction of real-time movies, or oners as they call them, you know, one-shot, one-take sequences, can often be very impressive but distancing at the same time, because you're looking for the seams. You're thinking about, all right, how did they do that? In some cases here, you're wondering, all right, how much of this is CGI? How much of this was planned after the fact? Is there somebody just off camera like yelling instructions at them to make sure the timing works out? But the film, in this case, I just found it so well crafted that most of that dropped away from me most of the time.
I've definitely seen the argument that like it's distracting, like the how did they do that element is distracting because you're looking for seams, or you're, you know, like you said, looking for what CGI. And I can understand that. That was not my experience at all. Like, I think like I was like kind of cognizant in the back of my mind of like, this is an impressive technical achievement. And like it came to the foreground during that part I mentioned where he gets knocked out and comes back to several hours later, which did feel like a very sort of obvious save point, I guess, you know. but for the most part, I was, again, just so immersed in the immediacy of what's happening, like, that I couldn't spare the brain space to be distracted by the how did they do that. If I saw it on second viewing, maybe that would happen. But again, I think that would make the viewing experience rewarding in a new way now that I've already experienced it in this very, to my mind, sort of purely visceral way.
I'd like to talk about the performances a little. We could talk about the cameos of famous people. Like, I suppose there is that sense of, here's somebody famous, it's a save point.
Yeah.
And it's a little stunty. I mean, knowing Benedict Cumberbatch is in the movie, you know pretty well who he's going to be. Like fairly early on.
I didn't know. I just heard him show up. I thought it was absurd.
You didn't what? Say, well,
why is Benedict Cumberbatch not allowed to be in other movies?
No, I just thought to have him in the to have him at that end point was a little bit cheesy.
It's the point that you're working towards in the movie is getting to meet Benedict Cumberbatch. It's clearly the climax.
I mean, I was in the movie to meet Richard Madden. I don't know about
I think that this is the touching story of a couple of young boys being handed a message by Colin Firth and told to deliver it to Cumberbatch. And, you know, then they have to cross...
After being warned by Mark Strong about Benedict Cumberbatch.
And then they have to cross the entirety of Hollywood in order to do it. It's kind of Under the Silver Lake with fewer weird clues and more gunfire. Speaking of Mark Strong, though, I do want to circle back to the performances, but I think this is a really interesting point. Mark Strong kind of sets up a dog that doesn't bark.
Yeah.
Like, Mark Strong sets up a very, like, based on his instructions, you know, have witnesses around you, like, some men just like the fight, he's not going to take this message well. You're being set up for like an almost Apocalypse Now kind of confrontation at the end with this commander who's like running rogue and taking over and is like willing to do whatever he can to achieve power and has possibly gone mad. And what you get is something very different. And the sheer relief of that, like, it's like Chekhov's gun doesn't go off. And this particular Chekhov's gun is such a war movie cliche. I was so braced for it for half of the film. And then that dog doesn't bark. We get there and he takes the orders and he steps down. And it was like such a visceral relief for me, both that the movie wasn't, you know, both on behalf of Schofield and his trials, but also just on behalf of the movie's story. Like, thank you for not going down that path. Did you feel disappointed?
Not really, but it's an odd thing to set up and not follow through on.
I feel like it does follow through on it. He does push back a little, but there are other people in the room, like Mark Strong said that there needed to be. And I think it highlights the fact that because we're so tied to Schofield and Blake's point of view, like, we only know what they know, you know, and we only get information that they get through superiors. So you kind of need Mark Strong saying that in order to give you the context for that dynamic at the end where Benedict Cumberbatch's character reacts as he does and the other men in the room kind of keep him from doing what Mark Strong warns he would do. So, like, I think that dog does bark, but it's a very sort of short and to the point bark. It's kind of a single bark.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, we'll get to the comparison with Gallipoli later, but we were originally going to compare this with Children of Men, and then I saw Gallipoli again and said, oh no, we really have to do this, because what 1917 reminded me of was like, what if Gallipoli, but the ending from The Player was imposed upon it? You know, what if it wasn't actually futile, this message that had been rushed to the front lines?
Yeah, that's
but futile. A lot of men die.
Yeah, I was going to say, there's an awful lot of killing for it to be a cop-out ending.
Yeah.
And yet people
like two
don't
waves
die,
had already
though.
Gone over.
Yeah, but you know,
it's a qualified victory, which I think is a pretty reasonable victory to give in a war movie.
It's glib, but I'm making the point. another thing that's interesting that I think about it, because I've been steeped in two things lately: World War One movies and Sam Mendes movies. Sam Mendes is kind of finding himself as a British person all of a sudden. Like, every film he did I think every film he did until the two James Bond movies and this were all set in the United States, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, so he's kind of found himself.
Well, I mean,
which one?
Jarhead. It's not
But they were among Americans. Jarhead is set among Americans. It's obviously not set in the United States, but it's an American story. I don't know what it all what it all means exactly, but I did feel like the James Bond side of Mendes kind of came into play here. His immense technical skill, his sense of movement and propulsiveness. I mean, this was kind of, it felt very removed for me from the spirit of a lot of World War One movies. It didn't feel to me like particularly like an anti-war film. I felt kind of, it's rousing. It's got, there's a freedom of movement here that's really uncommon in films about this war. In it, it's all, there's also a removal from context in a way, because you are locked into the experience of these two men who are on this mission, and it's a very narrow mission. And so what filters in from the war at large, I guess, is just what we take in from the landscape, I suppose, as they're making their way from point A to point B.
Yeah, but that landscape is what feels like the anti-war element of this film to me. Like the, you know, when they drop out of the trench and immediately like into the guts of one of their comrades, you know, crawling with rats, and like there's corpses everywhere. They're traversing the horrors of war, you know, and I worry that you are getting close to implying that this is a pro-war film. And I would strongly reject that.
No, I don't think that at all. I don't think that at all. And I think my favorite sequence in the movie is the one where they go to the abandoned underground bunker. And it's in some ways reminded me of a found footage horror film. Well, at the same time, also, there's sort of recognition of a shared humanity with these people they're fighting. And I thought that was an interesting combination of flavors to have going at once in this film.
This is the one with, like, the tripwire in it? And
right. But, the, you know, where they're going through, like, the dormitories, these underground dormitories, and finding, like, little bits left over from these German soldiers' private lives. And, you know, it's good stuff.
Okay. And there's also the whole thing with Schofield's medal, with him throwing it away. And Blake, that conversation really feels like an Archie Frank dynamic playing out there, you know, of Blake not understanding why he doesn't want to talk about his family, why he didn't keep his medal. Like, Blake has sort of this lingering idealism about the war, lingering romanticism, maybe, that Schofield has just been stripped of. You know, and we don't get necessarily the details of why, but I think to go back to the question we still haven't really answered about performances, I think that George MacKay is really effective in sort of translating what Schofield has been through without the script telling us.
I think that he and Chapman both give really strong performances here. Mm-hmm. And, you know, MacKay kind of has to anchor the film as both our point of view character and our path through all of this. And I think he's just tremendous, but I really miss Chapman at the point where he drops out of the film. Mm-hmm. You know, as soon as I understood that that was what was going to happen, that was what had to happen, I already missed their dynamic, because the back and forth between them was so much of what made the movie up until that point. It was what made it not feel like a video game, mm-hmm. you know, where it's just about the one player having a solo experience. Watching the two of them go back and forth with their banter, the silly story about the soldier who got his ear bitten off by a rat, but also just the clash of personalities, the why did you bring me on this thing? Like, why would you do this to me? I thought it was going to be easy. I thought I was getting you in for some free food. All of these different little threads between them in terms of their different personalities and the way those personalities come out, I think the degree to which it's just understated and natural is so important to this film. And I think they both handle it pretty masterfully.
Did everyone else recognize Dean Charles Chapman, or did you also have to go to IMDb?
Only later, when I looked at who it was, like, oh, yeah, of course that's who it is.
He's Tommen Baratheon from Game of Thrones.
Yeah, all grown
so
up.
So we have both a Baratheon and a Stark in this movie.
There's got to be other Game of Thrones players on here somewhere. That show employed, like, every British actor for 7 years or whatever.
Well, we don't get a whole lot of riding around on horses, so, you know, we don't have every stunt person from Game of Thrones.
I mean, he wasn't in Game of Thrones, but I was delighted by Andrew Scott. Like, it's a short role, but I mean, he, again, to kind of go back to sort of the glimpses of cynicism about war in this movie, I mean, he's more than a glimpse. I mean, that's just a deluge of cynicism coming at you, but he's so good in that short burst of time.
That's Lieutenant Leslie. Which character was that?
Before they even leave the trench, he's the one that is basically expressing a healthy heaping of doubt that the Germans have actually retreated, and he gives them the flare gun to let them know if they're actually gone.
Tasha, he's the hot priest slash
He is the Moriarty. Hot priest from Fleabag, yes.
I know about Moriarty, but yeah, I couldn't...
You haven't seen Fleabag?
I have not seen Fleabag.
It's very good.
You know,
I actually just started rewatching Fleabag last night.
People do tell me from time to time that show and also 367 other current shows are great and I need to watch them.
Yeah. Here's the thing about Fleabag. The whole season's only 3 hours. You can do it.
Oh, God bless you, Britain.
At the gym.
The things you do and or teach us.
I watched part of it at the gym.
I bet you did. What don't you watch at the gym these days?
Okay, well, clearly I need to spend more time both at the gym and in the iPod store because I don't have an iPod to watch films on at the gym.
iPod? iPad.
iPod.
I would not watch a film on an iPod.
Fine. iPod pad. iPid. iPod. Whatever. I don't care about your damn vowels, Keith.
Keith, when you go to the gym before you start working out, do you just say fast as a leopard to yourself?
I do now. After this episode, I will.
What is this treadmill? A series of springs. How fast is it going to make me run? Scott, you've been doing this all night.
Fast as a leopard.
There we go. It's definitely time to take a break. And after this break, we'll be back to talk about the connections between Gallipoli and 1917.
Did you hear that story about Wilco? How he lost his ear?
Not in the mood. Keep your eyes on the trees. Top of the ridge.
Bet he told you it was shrapnel.
What was it then?
Well, you know his girl's a hairdresser, right? And he was moaning about the lack of bathing facilities when he wrote to her. Remember those rancid Jake's at Harris?
Yeah.
Anyway. She sends him over this hair oil. Smells sweet. Like golden syrup. Wilco loves the smell. But he doesn't want to cast it around in his pack. So, he slathers it all over his bonnet. And goes to sleep. And in the middle of the night, he wakes up. And a rat is sitting on his shoulder. Licking the oil off his head. Wilco panics and he jumps up, and when he does, the rat bites clean through his ear and runs off with it.
Now it's time for connections, when we bring these two films together and talk about all the things they have in common. I want to start with something actually really light, and that's just the number of things that I don't know if these are... Obviously, Sam Mendes has to have seen Gallipoli. I'm wondering if... any of these things were actually inspired, or it's because it's coming from some of the same histories and source material. But the fact that both of them have a Kipling quote basically in the first like 10 minutes or so seems like too specific to be a complete coincidence.
It was the style of the time.
That and an onion in your belt. But there are all sorts of little things, like the Terrence Malick kind of influenced moment that we mentioned. Both films have a moment where there's somebody in the trenches kind of doing muscle man poses for somebody who's taking pictures. And it's kind of a light moment in a terrible setting of here's a little tourist shot for the folks back home. Like, here's something. People who are probably not going to live out the month are taking photos, you know, to remember them this moment by, as though it's a transient moment. Both films play very heavily with old photographs, with people like looking at these almost like daguerreotype photos of people in very stiff postures that they have with them as reminiscences of their family. These things are like very important touchstones for sentimentality that aren't commented on exactly. They're just kind of like brought out and presented, and you're meant to read like a whole world away into these images. And both of these films also feature like a moving song before battle, where the action stops and music plays and people gather around to listen and the emotion wells up. Like, are these things all coincidences? Are they all tropes, or is there an actual influence there?
You talk about the moving song before battle thing is a convention. You could also go back to Paths of Glory at the end of that movie. And I think there does tend to be a moment in a lot of war films like this, especially anti-war films, where you get to be reminded of the common humanity of the people who are fighting for just a second, you know, where you get this kind of pause and can have this thing where they're genuinely moved. I mean, nothing's going to top. Paths of Glory has got another great ending to a movie there. If you recall this German captive that they have, who gets, you know, mocked and jeered and whistled at, and then she starts singing this patriotic song, and everyone is just comes together and in a chorus, and is, you know, kind of sort of melts your heart. But it's nice. It's nice to have that. It's nice to take a breather. You know, and it's 1917 has those moments. Gallipoli certainly has most of the movie is those moments where you're given a chance to have a little bit of peace before heading into a terrifying adventure.
Yeah, I think all these things you're talking about are just sort of conventions that play well within war movies, because they're ways of expressing humanity within something that's so much bigger than one person, one and one human. You know, music is just a powerful unifier in any context, but especially before battle. You know, it's not unique to these films or Paths of Glory. I don't think the idea that music almost as prayer before going into battle. The one thing that is like feels specific to these two is the Kipling, but maybe again that's just sort of a time period thing. But everything else you mentioned just feels like something that stems out of these films being about war and being about real people at the center of war and having to express that amid the atrocities of that war in succinct ways.
The Kipling thing just struck me as such a particularly specific coincidence, in part because it's used so differently in these stories. Like, as we mentioned, the reading from a Jungle Book is meant to kind of set up this idea of innocence lost and manhood found. But in 1917, it's a quote from a poem, and it comes from Colin Firth's character, and it's meant in part to kind of evoke his elitism, you know, his upper class education. It's meant as kind of a touchstone of like of who he is. He's quoting this like little snippet of famous British poetry before a battle, and that poem is also a pretty cynical poem. Mm. I mean, it's also sort of a presaging where we're going to go in the movie. Because as he said it, down to Gehenna or up to the throne, he travels fastest who travels alone. I thought, well, they're not traveling alone. They're two men traveling together. But of course, he's giving you a little foreshadowing that it's going to be traveling alone before terribly long. So the fact that if they were used in remotely like similar ways, it might feel like a trope or an echo, but it still, to me, almost feels like a specific reference. That's just maybe, for me, the biggest rhyme between these two films, apart from, you know, the obvious idea of men like lunging up out of the trenches to die, and like the just the setting, the design of the trenches and how similar they look, is just how much they both rely on how young men do and don't communicate. There's so much, especially around war, there's so much in both of these films that goes unsaid, specifically because young men are uncomfortable talking about their emotions with each other. They're all in this place of terror and danger, and they very, very rarely talk about it in any specific way. You can see it on their faces. You can see it in their actions, but they have sort of like quiet moments together where they expressly don't talk about it, or they kind of bluffly show a strength that they don't feel. Sometimes they're over the top and jokey, like Frank and his pals. Sometimes they're just grim and quiet, like Sho and Blake dealing with their near-death experience after the tunnels, but they don't talk about it expressly. And so much of the emotion in both of these movies, to me, goes unsaid specifically because these are all men, all young men who cannot express their fear in any socially acceptable way except to gut it out and just be tough.
This is a nice contrast too in 1917 in the scene in the back of the truck where Schofield has already been through so much. He's already lost his friend. The situation is extremely urgent at this point in terms of the timeline to get this message across, and he's in this truck that's going to lead him to where he needs to be. Hopefully, they of course eventually get stuck in the mud and have to, you know, video game their way out of that situation. But like, but when he's in the back of that truck with those other guys, there's such a contrast between how we know that he's feeling and the kind of banter that happens between men in these situations where it is terrifying to be there, but there's a lot of just rowdiness and guys riling each other up. And I mean, I think that's the that all feels very real.
I like that sequence a lot, because just imagine going through the most horrific thing you've experienced in your life, and then being around a bunch of guys who are just doing their best to keep it light, you know?
Yeah.
No, and there's no way to communicate it to them. You know, he can't tell them what he's just been through. It either would mean nothing to them, or it would mean something to them and they'd want to shut it down because they don't want to be in the place that he is. Yeah. But he also can't really, it's too new and fresh for him to take any comfort from what they're doing, from the bluffness. And I think, like, even more speaking to the amazing construction of that sequence, they're all bonding by making fun of somebody he's never met and has never heard. Like, they all have this shared experience that they're tapping into. Even this foreigner who they mock for his foreignness, his accent and his skin and his voice, even he is like part of this shared experience, making fun of this officer. And this is an officer that the show has never seen and knows nothing about. He's shut out of their experience in every imaginable way. And then he creates a shared moment by expressing emotion. Like, I was not expecting them to get the truck out of the mud. I thought that was going to be narratively how he parted from them, because he had to move on and they couldn't. But instead, they're all kind of slackers and there's nobody there telling them that they have to do this work. But they see how desperate he is, and they're moved by it, again, without saying anything about it.
Yeah, I mean, he eventually does have to kind of communicate to them this is a big deal. And they can see in the way that he's trying to do this himself, desperately trying to get this vehicle out of the mud, how important it is. And so they kind of spring into action at that point, but not before then.
Yeah, and his distress and desperation comes across so clearly in that moment, and so rarely otherwise, you know, because everybody in both of these movies is either tamped down or covering it all up with bluffness. I mean, you think about the Gallipoli's naked swimming scene, like, that's just some whistling past the grave. Like, we're here on the edge of battle, so, like, we're going to get naked and have some fun, and then we're getting shot at, and we're going to kind of turn that into a joke, too. It's all so light and playful and, again, boyish.
When men are around each other, and certainly in a situation like that, there is going to
be... They get naked a lot?
Well, no, there's just a need to prove that you're tough, you know?
Yeah, and that's the problem you and I hang out, Scott.
Yeah, yeah.
Always just trying to best one another at, you know, arm wrestling and things like that.
Yeah.
I imagine there's a lot of grunting. A lot of very manly grunting.
Definitely, definitely. God, we should do that. One day we need to do Beau Travail, the Claire Denis film, because that takes that dynamic to its homoerotic extremes. But, you know, I mean, that's how they go to each other. I mean, they not only go to each other in this, you know, while they're on the front, but, you know, often just to get to battle as well. I mean, this is how you know, Archie convinces Frank to go to war. You kind of goad him, you know. And I mean, you know, it's almost on a dare that Frank ultimately, you know, makes this fateful decision.
Do you guys see a homoeroticism in these movies? I feel like 1917 just doesn't have time for that. Like, almost doesn't have time for emotional feeling apart from the moment with the woman and the baby. Which, let me tell you, when that happened, I was like, why didn't we do Children of Men again? This was the wrong choice. We've made a terrible, terrible mistake.
That said, and I feel bad saying it because it's the only scene in the film with a woman, but I could have done without the woman and a baby in 1917.
the feeling that the only place for a woman in this story is to be cradling a baby.
Yeah. It isn't hers. That's not a very hopeful situation, ultimately.
No, that's kind of terrifying. Well, but
to answer your question, I think in some ways it's asking the wrong question, because, you know, if nothing else, Warfield was talking about, give it a chance to talk about close social bonds between men, whether or not we talk about any sort of repressed sexual element to it. I mean, certainly that is an element that's in many war films. To see Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence, if you want like the best example of that, which is all about repressed sexual tension. But I think men aren't really allowed to express feelings for each other in many outside of situations like war, often in the culture in which we live. It's particularly, the culture of World War I. So I think it opens up opportunities like that. I don't really feel like there's repressed desire between Archie and Frank, but I think they have a very deep bond. And I think Gallipoli explores that very thoroughly.
Yeah. Reading what I quoted in the last episode about mateship was kind of clarifying to me, because in reading about Gallipoli, I definitely saw some mentions of homoeroticism that I could see reading into the film, but knowing about this idea of mateship, of friendship that is more than just friendship, that there's this intense loyalty there, was sort of clarifying in the way that relationship is portrayed. And I think like there's maybe a little bit of a contrast in 1917 in terms of like national identity as it affects how these young men relate to each other. Like there is a little bit of jocular back and forth in that scene you mentioned in the truck, but there's also a lot of just sort of stoicism, the proverbial stiff upper lip, especially coming from Sho toward Blake, who comes off as the sort of the more puppy dog of the two of them, and I don't feel the same sort of camaraderie between them, the same sort of affection between them that I feel between Frank and Archie, while still recognizing that there is a bond there that is formed through shared experience.
I don't know. To me, there's the Archie-Frank bond is almost, it's pretty close to at first glance. I mean, it comes almost immediately after that foot race.
First they hate each other, then they love each other.
Well, first they compete with each other, and then they have a little meeting in a cafe where Archie gives up his breakfast to make sure Frank gets a meal. I don't know. There's something just about the way they look at each other throughout this film, and the gladness when they re-encounter each other, and the immediate, well, you've got to come join my unit thing that they do, and the boyish galloping away of that. The bond between them is clearly stronger than Frank's bond with his other friends, because he does not give a single thought to abandoning those other friends, and they let him know it.
They're so offended when he shows up with his light horseman hat with his feather in it. They're like, yeah.
Well, of course they are. Of course they are, because he's abandoned them. He's abandoned them. He does not think for a moment about the fact that he's abandoning them for posher digs and a better outfit. I mean that literally. I mean the outfit that he has on, as opposed to the light horse being a better outfit, although that also is probably true. But he comes to show off to them, and they resent it deeply. And it is one of the few places where we get to see like a strong personal emotion surface, because they deeply resent him, for what he's done, for what he's saying about their friendship and how little he cares for it. But his bond with Archie is much more personal. And to me, there is like a slightly homoerotic element to that.
I don't know. It feels more like admiration on Frank's part to me. Like they do share something that Frank doesn't share with his other mates. They're both runners. But I think that, and we talked about this in the first half about, what pushes Frank to follow Archie into war. And I think that there is a sort of, I think Frank does respond to Archie's idealism, his golden boyness. He beat him at the race, I think there is a part of Frank that wants not to be Archie, but like wants certain traits that Archie has. So I think the connection that he has to him is rooted in that more than desire, but it's all those two things can tangle together in a way that, again, I can see where the claims of homoeroticism come from, but that's just not how I ended up reading it in the end.
Both of these movies have a lot to say about cowardice versus courage and about the response to duty. I see a pretty strong connection between Blake with his willingness to just charge over the front lines and into danger for his brother. Like he's in theory doing it for these 1599 other men who stand to die, but in part he's blindly charging forward, and Schofield calls him on it. He says like, we can wait, we can plan, we can hold this until dark. And Blake just wants to charge forward. And it feels so much like the way Archie wants to charge into war for his country without really considering the ramifications or worrying about the costs. There's, in both cases, in both of these movies, we have people who are braver and people who are more afraid, people who, you know, hold back from what is perceived as their duty, and people who kind of preachily jump into it. And in both cases, it just seems like sort of a natural way to deal with a pairing of two people is to have this contrast between them and have it, you know, bring up some tension, both narratively and personally.
I mean, Blake is sort of chosen for that reason, though, right? On the part of leadership,
it's a calculation
that nothing's going to put fire in the kid's belly, like telling him that his brother's going to die unless he gets him that message. I mean, that's going to cause him to get there as quickly as possible, which is what they want him to do, which is another thing that ties into, to, you know, I'm not going to distance myself from this topic that you just brought up, but leadership is such an important part of these films. The failure of the arrogance of leadership, the failures of leadership are so critical to understanding both of these films and to understanding World War One, you know, more generally. And, you know, and ultimately the grunts are there at the mercy of these decisions. And
yeah,
and
that's just it. I mean, as an officer, if you make a mistake, you know, you made a mistake.
You get promoted in Paths of Glory.
Yeah, going back to Paths of Glory, it's like, you know, it is just a series of decisions you make, and maybe it weighs heavily on you, maybe it doesn't, depending on who, what your character is like. But for the men, you know, on the front lines, it means something different entirely.
Yeah, I mean, you don't get necessarily get a sense, you know, I think with Gallipoli in 1917, there's maybe a little bit more of a sense in both films that leadership does feel responsible for the people that they're sending out to war. I mean, the films are not so cynical about that. They make flawed decisions, but they're not reckless like they are in a lot of other World War One movies, where they're just not only sending people knowingly to their doom, but then, you know, in something like Paths of Glory, arbitrarily punishing them in order for them to save face and get their promotion or whatever and move up in a leadership capacity. So there's a real cruelty there too, and a real sense that these guys are disposable.
As both of these films are dealing with leadership and leadership failures, I think it's worth noting that they both make a conscious separation between like the high up leadership, the echelon of leadership that's actually making these decisions and sending people over the top, over the trenches, and the lower down leadership, you know, the sergeants who are on the line, who are kind of overseeing a bunch of soldiers and making decisions for them and acting as gatekeepers between them and danger. You know, you have the man who stands by the dangerous spot in Gallipoli and lets people know, like, past this line, you will get shot. And he's like a little guardian. Like, later you see Frank have to cross that line as a shortcut to get where he needs to go as fast as possible. But he's expressly told by somebody who stands there and holds the gate. And it's exactly the same sort of role that Andrew Scott plays as the sergeant in charge of kind of the end of the trenches. Both of them are just kind of like little leaders, like little gatekeepers, letting soldiers know, like, past this point, abandon hope. Like, there's literally a sign that says that in Gallipoli at the end of that trench. But
there's also these sort of like noble officer figures in Gallipoli. There's Barton, the one who is actually, you know, in the trenches with the men and ordering them over the line, and in the third wave decides to go over with them, but he's the one who's, you know, on the phone with the officer making this bad call, you know. And then I think like the Mark Strong character in 1917 is a little that too, sort of the buffer between the grunt and the higher up officer. But it strikes me, like, as we're talking this out, that both of these films, and this is maybe just the most straightforward connection between them, is that they're movies where grunts, privates, low-ranking military are sent on a mission to correct the bad decisions of officers, you know, and it happens over a much shorter span of time in Gallipoli, you know, and it's a literal like race back and forth through the trenches. But it's sort of just like a compression of what happens in 1917 of like sending this message to stop a massacre. And in neither case are they entirely successful. In 1917, arguably, he's slightly more successful, but as already mentioned, there's still a ton of casualties. So sort of the idea of like correcting the poor choices of leadership through the blood, sweat, and tears of soldiers.
Are these films both equally anti-war films?
That's tough because I mean, you know, we're inevitably had to grapple with the Truffaut quote about anti-war, which I have queued up here because it often gets misquoted. I think it's something he may have said a couple of different times, but it comes originally or most famously from an interview with Gene Siskel of our own Chicago, hometown of Chicago, from 1973, where he says, Siskel asks, "There's very little killing in your films. How come?"
Truffaut, blunt and Siskel-y.
Truffaut says, "I find that violence is very ambiguous in movies. For example, some films claim to be anti-war, but I don't think I've ever really seen an anti-war film. Every film about war ends up being pro-war." And then Siskel follows up, "Even a film like Kubrick's Paths of Glory or his Dr. Strangelove," to which Truffaut replies, "Yes, I think Kubrick likes violence very much." And then there's the whole side where Siskel talks about how he had to grapple with this for weeks and then eventually found himself agreeing with him. But, you know, I think there's something to this because there you can think of the wave of from Apocalypse Now through Platoon and so on about these horrific depictions of war and all their violence. That goes all the way back to at least All Quiet on the Western Front, which is a horrifically violent film.
Yeah.
Upsettingly, it really depicts the horrors of warfare down to like, you know, you never sleep because the bombing never stops. But at the same time, you read the book Jarhead and Anthony Swofford talks about how he and the other or the soldiers would get pumped up by or in training at least get pumped up about being soldiers by watching these same movies. Full Metal Jacket included. Yeah. When R. Lee Ermey died, Swofford had an editorial in the New York Times about how Full Metal Jacket made his generation hungry to go to war.
Yeah.
And so you kind of wonder if maybe there's something, maybe they're, you know, intent aside, they can't be. But that being said, I feel like Gallipoli is, there's no romanticization of the actual fighting. I think there's a romanticization of the men who do the fighting, but I think that's the bluntest depiction I've seen about how sometimes you die your first time you go to battle, and that's just the way it is. It's hard to feel, you know, an experience you want to do when there's so little excitement. It's just instant death.
Well, and Gallipoli just engages so much with the idea of enticement to war. Like, so much of its story is about showing how young men are frankly tricked into going to war. You know, I think the Truffaut criticism could maybe be leveled at 1917 a little more, and maybe Scott, that's what you were getting at earlier when I bristled it. But again, like, I just, the way that death just hangs over that movie, just the way corpses are literally like embedded in the landscape they're traversing, I don't think of 1917 is a particularly violent movie. I think of it as a death-obsessed movie, but I don't think it's necessarily reveling in violence. The violence that we do get is like these sort of shock moments, but you're not pummeled with it.
Yeah, I guess my hang-up, though, with 1917 is that if you are a soldier and you are imagining a best-case scenario for what your war experience might be, being able to traverse this no man's land on this extraordinarily consequential life-saving mission and being able to accomplish it, being able just to move in World War One at all, to get out of the trenches, to be out in the open, to take action, it doesn't leave that the kind of impression that a more strictly anti-war film would leave. Whereas Gallipoli, it's like Gallipoli is almost like a war version of Scatman Crothers in The Shining, of just like, he's going to go on this, and he's going to, you know, the kid's going to summon him, and we watch him take this incredible, difficult, arduous journey to the Overlook just to get, you know, axed by Jack Nicholson. And, you know,
spoiler.
Oh, people know that. Goodness gracious. I can't be doing
They've
that.
They've watched the film on their iPads at the gym.
It's a 40-year-old film. Statute of Limitations has passed. So, I mean, I don't want to be glib about it again, but there is kind of a level of excitement and achievement to 1917. And also, you know, it doesn't feel as gritty or as grim as a lot of other war films do to me.
I don't agree with that, but I think maybe where the issue lies with 1917 is, I mean, this is a film intended to honor Sam Mendes's grandfather, you know, there is this sort of element of glorification happening of the brave soldier. So I think that is where this element is coming from. So I understand that reading, especially in the context of celebrating heroism. But again, this is just my reaction to the film and maybe just sort of my squeamishness with gore and death. But, you know, I was so affected by the way that bodies are strewn across this film in very sort of matter-of-fact ways that, to my mind, just is very clarifying about the reality of war. That was my reaction. Your mileage may vary.
Well, you can decide for yourself. 1917 is currently in theaters. Gallipoli is available free on Amazon Prime for people who already subscribe. It's also available for rental for non-subscribers. It's widely available on a number of streaming services, and it's available on DVD startlingly cheaply. We'll be right back with your next picture show. Finally, it's time to catch each other up on films or film-related items we've seen in the interim since our last podcast. We call this Your Next Picture Show in the hopes that it'll put some interesting choices on your radar. Scott, what in the film world has been good for you lately?
Well, as I've said in the last couple of weeks, I was really immersed in World War I movies. I wrote a piece for The Guardian, which you can look up, about that was pegged to 1917 about the history of World War I movies, some of the more significant ones, what they have to say about the war. I didn't do it as a list. I did it kind of as an essay, and I was pretty happy with the way it turned out. But I was able to catch a couple of classic films, really early classic films that were made in the wake of the war that I'd never seen before and that kind of blew me away. The first was The Big Parade from 1925. This is a King Vidor movie about this character who's a sort of a lazy American aristocrat who's sort of coaxed by his father into the Great War. He and a couple of, you know, working class dudes he befriends, they all go off to France, and the film spends a tremendous amount of time, I mean, maybe Gallipoli, like, you know, just getting to the war. I mean, and he ends up having this affair, or there's sort of this love story involving him and a French woman. They don't speak the same language, but they speak the language of love, and you get a really beautiful farewell scene between the two of them, and then it gives you extraordinarily well-staged action, a march through the woods that's really dramatic, where they go to confront the Germans, a very harrowing scene at in the evening where they're in this trench under cover of darkness, but told that they have to try to take out a German machine gun nest, and there's a realization among these three guys that whoever volunteers for this assignment is probably not coming back. And it's a very, very, very big, moving film. And then I saw All Quiet on the Western Front, which I'd never seen. And it's one of the great war films I've ever seen, easily. I couldn't believe how bluntly anti-war and yet artful and humane the film was. I mean, it really presents World War I as an act of grand-scale nihilism, where these German students are told by their instructor or rallied by their teacher to join the cause, and they're shipped to the front lines on promises of glory, and all they experience is just endless days and unending horror. You know, and our hero comes back to the same classroom later in the movie, and the same teacher is trying to present him as a hero and trying to convince a younger set of kids to do the same thing that he did, and for what reason. It is just so sharp, so powerful, beautifully shot on an absolutely epic scale. Won Best Picture. So, I mean, it's a great Best Picture winner.
I saw that one recently for the first time too. It kind of blew me away too. And I mentioned Stretch by Lewis Milestone. I think my only complaint with this version is that it's a very early sound
early
film,
sound, yeah.
And some of the actors are still acting for silent film.
Yeah, no, it's not. It's blunt. It is blunt. Very, very blunt and very,
But who was the guy who played the sergeant? I looked him up. He died not too long after the film was made. He was also on the front page. Anyway, he was
great. Yeah, no, it's a very, very good movie.
And one thing about that also, I mean, for my complaints about some of the acting being not quite up to speed with the sound era, the sound is aggressive and assaultive in that film. The actual sound of warfare, it's amazing. Yeah, used amazingly.
And one of the problems with the early sound movies is that the camera didn't move
very
much. But this is not that the case because there's so much action in the film. And when you are out of a dialogue scene, when you are in the field, it's got all of the dynamism that you expect and love in late silent films. It's got the camera's all over the place, and it's really exciting. So, All Quiet on the Western Front and The Big Parade, I enjoyed them very much. What about you, Genevieve?
Okay, well, I'm going to take us away from war movies for something completely different. I want to talk about a 2019 documentary that I recently caught up with called The Biggest Little Farm, which is a sort of feature-length video essay by John Chester, an Emmy-winning wildlife filmmaker who, about 8 years ago, quit the business to start an organic, sustainable farm in California with his wife, Molly, a traditional foods chef and blogger. The film covers the first few years of their operation, which is called Apricot Lane Farms, and is now a thriving success, but began as this sort of harebrained scheme on their parts to revive 200 acres of dried-out farmland via a commitment to biodiversity and restoring a natural, self-sustaining ecosystem, one where crops and livestock are able to coexist alongside pests and predators. By the way, and they had zero farming experience when they set out to do this. The film makes clear again and again that this is far from the norm in modern agriculture and is arguably a little self-congratulatory in the way it presents Apricot Lane as this bastion of forward-thinking farming philosophy. But it makes up for that tendency by illustrating just the avalanche of challenges the Chesters had to face to get there, literal years of trial and error and uncertainty on their parts. But what really struck me about the film was the form it takes, which is sort of this series of stories built around a different animal, which flow into each other in a manner that illustrates the idea that every resident of the farm, from the human farmers right on down to the gophers and snails who infiltrate their orchards, has a role to play if this project is going to be truly self-sustaining. The challenge is figuring out what that role is and how to implement it. And one of the pleasures of The Biggest Little Farm is seeing those solutions form and play out. And given Chester's background in wildlife photography, those challenges and solutions are portrayed in a really lovely, often impressionistic way that keeps the natural world at the center of the story, with the Chesters themselves acting more like supporting players. The film has narration from John that gives it a sort of diary-like feel, but there are no talking heads or outside experts coming in to analyze what we're seeing, which gives the film this really intimate feeling and complements its ideas about the interconnectivity of the natural world and humans' place in it. It's a film that clearly sets out to be inspiring, and whether you feel that inspiration is probably going to be a matter of how much you connect to what the Chesters are doing with this project, but it definitely worked on me, so I'm going to recommend The Biggest Little Farm, which is streaming for free on Amazon Prime if you're a subscriber, and rentable pretty much everywhere else.
Yeah, you know, I have to say, you know, Neon, which distributed this film, that film, I mean, 2019 was absolutely, absolutely astonishing year for this company. This company put out that movie, Parasite, Portrait of a Lady on Fire, Honeyland, Amazing Grace, Apollo 11. I mean, that is a, you know, Manos, Luce, you know, Clemency, you know, The Beach Bum. They have everything. It's like, that is a huge lineup. I mean, we talk about A24 as this sort of like, as the model of a boutique company, but man, Neon gave them a run for their money in 2019, no?
It was a pretty exciting day when the screener booklet for that showed up. Yeah. It was not the most exciting screener season for critics this year, but Neon just sent a booklet with every film that you just mentioned in it.
Unreal.
And I was like, this is a feast.
Tasha, what about you?
Well, I'll try to keep this short because there's a lot to it. I feel like it would be criminal of me, given that we're talking about 1917, to not point out that if you liked George MacKay in this film, you should see Marrowbone, which I believe I recommended on a previous Next Picture show. It's the horror film where he and his younger siblings are all trying to pretend that their mother hasn't died so they can stay together and keep their estate. But there's something dreadfully wrong on that estate. estate. There's a presence that's haunting them because of something they did due to a break in the story that's not entirely unlike the break in the story that happens in 1917. McKay is just an amazing performer, especially for somebody so young. He brings across so much in his kind of simultaneous attempts to portray emotion and repression of emotion. And everything he brings to 1917, he also brings to Marrowbone. I love it. It's a very under-released and underseen film. It's one of those films that a very few people have seen because of me talking it up on this podcast. And several of them have come back to me to say, thank you so much for recommending this film. So, which, by the way, it feels like there's been an uptick in that lately, and I cannot say how thrilled I am when people actually come around and say, I saw this film because of you, and thank you for it, because I love it. But Marrowbone is one of those movies that I'm just going to stump for into eternity. It's so well crafted, it's so well executed, and McKay is a huge part of that. In the same sort of vein, in terms of movies I will stump for forever, if you like the continuous shot idea in a film and you want to see one that was actually continuously shot as opposed to the faux continuous shot thing done here, Sebastian Schipper's Victoria, still a huge favorite of mine. And it's an impeccably constructed single shot feature film put together on the streets of Berlin extremely early in the morning. It's a story about a woman who goes to a club, meets some guys, follows that thread where it leads, ends up in some rather horrible trouble. There's violence, there's beauty, there's music, there's dancing, there's emotion, there's hiding from emotion. All sorts of things happen, but it's all literally done in a single shot. And I interviewed Schipper for RogerEbert.com back when the film came out, and he said he couldn't get the film into festivals because nobody believed it. They thought that he was lying to gain admission, and they didn't want to fall for it. But this really is a film constructed as a long journey into night around a single shot. And it might be a little distracting the first time you see it as you're trying to figure out what's going to come next, how the story could take the natural escalation of story to the next level while still maintaining the single shot, whether there's a point where it's all going to fall apart. It features a tremendous central performance from Laia Costa as the eponymous Victoria. It's a beautiful film, and it's just an amazing piece of film craft. Scott, you've been nodding this entire time.
Yeah. Well, you're a shipper.
I'm not a shipper for him. I don't have anybody I'm shipping know, him with.
But I remember that actor, Costa, was in a movie called Duck Butter. A little movie called Duck Butter. But I have always intended to see that film, Tasha, on your recommendation. I've failed repeatedly.
Finally, I don't know whether it's still going to be in theaters by the time this podcast comes out, because we're recording so far in advance for a change. But for fans of Your Name, back in 2016, the Japanese film about a boy and girl experiencing each other's lives across time.
I like that movie.
Yeah, as well you should. It was a fantastic film. The writer-director, Makoto Shinkai, has a new one out in theaters. It's a G-Kids release, so it will be available on streaming and DVD fairly shortly in your choice of voiced by celebrity version or original subtitled version. But as we're recording this, it's about to hit theaters. And because it's a limited release, I'm going to live in the hope that it's going to have like a slow enough rollout that people might still be able to catch it in theaters by the time this comes out, because much like Your Name, it's something you can watch at home, but you should watch in theaters. The music in this film is stunning. It's stunningly moving. But the visuals, my God. The movie's story is about a young man who runs away and moves to Tokyo and is trying to survive. And he meets a young woman who literally has the power to create sunshine. When she prays, she can stop the rain and bring sun into people's lives for a short period of time. It's a supernatural story, but it's also very metaphorical. But what matters almost isn't the story. It's how impeccably beautiful the cinematography is. This world is so well developed. It reminds me of Studio Ghibli's movies, just in terms of the way in a Studio Ghibli movie, when people sit down to a feast, you can see like the individual droplets of oil on the sheen of the surface of a fatty soup. You can see the texture of the wood grain in the furniture. That is what this movie is like. There was a point in Weathering With You where a man is standing in a bathroom doing something in the mirror, shaving or brushing his teeth, something like that. I don't remember because I didn't notice. I was so busy looking at the texture of the crimping on the plastic bottles of bathroom substances on the counter in front of him. This movie is so much about crowded, claustrophobic spaces full of amazingly detailed things and vast cityscapes and the rain coming down and the detail of all of these things. It is literally one of the most beautiful movies I've ever seen. Mm. And it's emotionally moving. It's a very unique story, very well told in the Japanese style of kind of like huge, overblown emotions about young love and what it feels like to be a young boy experiencing his first welling feelings of pure love for a young girl. But on top of all of the structure and the very strange story movements that happen, it's an experience for the theater. It's a feast for the eyes and the soul. So Weathering With You and those other two movies, Marrowbone and Victoria. Keith, what about you?
Well, it's a qualified recommendation of a troubled, imperfect film. But we love those, right? We love the troubled, imperfect, compelling films.
So much.
So in 1984, Francis Ford Coppola was it wasn't at a high point in his career. He had some money troubles. Zoetrope his studio was in big trouble. One from the Heart was not a hit, to put it mildly. He needed a hit, so he took a job with his old producer Robert Evans, who had a dream project about the New York Cotton Club, site of jazz and crime. And from a story originally penned by Mario Puzo, so it's the whole Godfather team back together. But mm-hmm. It was a deeply troubled production in which, there were Coppola and Evans had a falling out. There was a murder of one of the financiers. You can read all about that somewhere. Anyway, the film came out, wasn't a great hit, and it wasn't that well received. And it kind of was sort of something that probably Coppola completists would watch and no one else. But Coppola is not one to let his old films go, as we know from the three different cuts of Apocalypse Now. Mm-hmm. The story goes, he found a Betamax copy of his original cut and decided, you know what, the world needs to see this. And he released briefly to theaters and played some festivals as the Cotton Club : Encore. This is the version that's now available on DVD and Blu-ray and only available to rent through Apple. And apparently this is the only version of the film you can stream anywhere. I had never seen the old version. I saw this. It is still an imperfect film, but comparisons to The Godfather do it no favor. And the characters are much less compelling than that. The story is less compelling, but there's a whole lot to like about it. I mean, it's just an incredibly well-made film with some neat performances in it. Bob Hoskins and Fred Gwynne are play like a pair of criminals who work together. And just the visual of Hoskins standing next to Gwynne is itself is pretty delightful. That's
a different height difference there.
And I read Odie Henderson's review of this at RogerEbert.com, where he described what was added and what was taken out. And it's like, oh, all my favorite parts weren't in the original version, which is a lot more musical sequence, a lot more balance between, there's basically two romances at the center of this movie, one between Richard Gere and Diane Lane, the other between Gregory Hines and Lynette McKee. And unshockingly, the studio decided, let's emphasize the white characters more than the black characters. So this kind of restores that balance. It's got great stuff in it. It's not a perfect movie. It's a movie I end up liking quite a bit and would definitely recommend, particularly if you've seen other, if you like Coppola, if you like jazz music, if you like beautiful costumes and Gunfire, that's in there too. Scott, you've seen the original,
The original, but not the encore. So, and the original is indeed.
I can loan it to you.
I would like that. I would like to see the encore version because the original, it's just flat. It's just fundamentally doesn't move like a god, like the Godfather. The stories, the, you know, Godfather's is full of anecdotes and little crime stories and things that kind of give it life, and this one just doesn't quite get there. Mm. But I love to look at it, and I loved certain sequences. Gregory Hines is tap dances, I believe.
There's a lot more Gregory Hines, and Gregory Hines' brother.
Terrific.
And Maurice Hines, when they play brothers in the film, too. There's a whole like double number that's apparently not in the original cut.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it for sure.
And that about wraps it up.
Yeah, that does about wrap it up. That is a lot for people to watch. So we will close up here and let them get on with it. And that's it for this edition of the Next Picture Show. Our next pairing will come out February 11th and 18th. Scott, what is coming up next?
So in 1993, Australian director Jane Campion won the Palme d'Or at the Cannes Film Festival with The Piano, a feminist love story set against a repressive period backdrop. Flash forward 26 years later, and French director Céline Sciamma caused a sensation of her own in Cannes with Portrait of a Lady on Fire, also a feminist love story set against a repressive period backdrop. Both films are about protagonists who express themselves through art, and both are about how they negotiate freedom in a world that's set to squash their desires. On the next episode of The Next Picture Show, we'll compare these Cannes sensations and how they use the distant past to comment on the present.
In the meantime, we would love to hear your feedback on this week's discussion of Gallipoli, 1917, and anything else film-related you'd like to talk about. We want to include your thoughts on future episodes of the show. You can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. We may post your response on Facebook for discussion or read it on a future episode of the show. Finally, before we close out this week's episode, where can we find everyone these days? Genevieve?
I am the deputy TV editor at vulture.com, and you can find me on Twitter at Genevieve Kosky. Scott?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at @Scott_Tobias. You can find my work on New York Times, Washington Post, NPR, The Ringer, and other fine outlets. Keith?
You can find me on Twitter at KFIPS3000. You can find my work at Vulture. You can find my work at The Ringer, Rolling Stone, Fangoria, Mel. Covers it. That's the place I'm working for right now, but you know, I'm out there. Tasha, how about you?
You can find me at Polygon.com, where I'm the film and TV editor. You can find me on Twitter at Tasha Robinson. You can stay updated on The Next Picture Show by visiting nextpictureshow.net, on Twitter at nextpicturepod, and via Facebook at facebook.com/nextpictureshow. You can also contribute to our Patreon and get bonus content at patreon.com/nextpictureshow. And if you haven't subscribed to the show on Apple Podcasts already, please consider it. Apple Podcast subscriptions are an important part of getting podcasts more prominence and more listeners. While you're there, we appreciate every rating and review. Every thumbs up helps us find new listeners and keep the show going. Come find us on Twitter and let us know if you watch movies we recommend. We always love to hear about your experiences. Thanks to Dan the Snake Jakes for his assistance in producing this podcast. The Next Picture Show is proud to be part of the Film Spotting family of podcasts. Please tune in next time.
I want to wait. A crown of glory when I get home to that bright land. I want to shout salvation story in concert with that blood-washed band. Savior, to sing his praises forevermore. I'm only going.